Hello again and welcome to another story-filled episode of Musings on Golf. I'm Kelly Elbin, and along with Bob Bupka, we'll talk Scottie Scheffler's six-pack of victories, Padraig Harrington heading to the U.S. Senior Open this week by winning the same event a third straight time on Sunday. But Robert, as we record this, we just finished not too long ago talking with our very special guest, Rhett Evans, the CEO of the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America, who recently reached the top of Mount Everest. What a story. What an interview our listeners have coming up.
Absolutely, Kelly. You know, basically, it's not fair to call that interview special. I mean, when people hear what transpired, what physical demands, what mental demands, including the lives of fellow climbers, I mean, it is a story beyond stories. It'll serve as an inspiration to anybody that'll take the time to listen to Rhett Evans. We can't thank him enough. His inspirational words.
Right. Sometimes we have interviews that really touch us, right, Bob? And that was one of them. And I agree with you. I think we'll hear what he has to say. And Bob, Rhett is a very modest fellow. He is not the type who's going to pound his chest and tell you how great he is. But it truly is a tale of perseverance. It's a tale of preparation. To say that it was something that anybody could do, no. But Rhett was certainly up to the task.
He was. And anytime anybody hears in their lifetime going forward, you probably could do it. Might be a little challenging. I want them to think of the experience of Rhett Evans, and that'll provide the motivational fuel for you to accomplish your own personal challenge. If you want it enough, you can get it done.
I love it. I thought the messages were great. Scottie Scheffler, Bob, it's, you know, six wins on the PGA Tour, and we're just into July. You know, he obviously didn't play very well at the U.S. Open. I don't know if it was the greens at Pinehurst. I don't know if he was just, frankly, kind of exhausted. He played well, obviously, and won at Jack's tournament the week before. But, boy, that engine started right back up. There's a very special relationship he has as well with Tom Kim. Not only do they share the same birthday, Scotty turned 28 last Friday. Tom Kim turned 22. There's a lot of mutual respect there. Tom's going to win his fair share. Bob, Tom Kim and the rest are going to really have to play well for the next few years to beat Scottie Scheffler, who just seems almost invincible when he's got it going.
You know, it's amazing. When I look back, I would venture to say close to 99% of the players playing out on the PGA Tour right now would be very satisfied if they could win what Ted Scott has earned just this season. As a caddy, 2.9 million, six victories by Scottie Scheffler, eclipsing the mark of Arnold Palmer, tied the mark of Arnold Palmer, winning six before the month of July. And that was accomplished back in 1962.
Well, that team of Randy Smith, Scottie's coach, who we've had on our show, obviously Ted Scott, it's a strong team that he has. Bob, you know, when Tiger's name used to go up on the leaderboard in his heyday, it was like the others were saying, oh my gosh, here we go. I'm wondering, are we starting to get there with Scottie Scheffler? Once his name goes up on the leaderboard, everybody, and I'm talking about his peers out there trying to beat him, everybody takes notice.
Excellent point there, Kelly. And I don't know if it's achieved that level yet, but if he keeps going, he could achieve that level just this year alone.
Let's hear what Scottie had to say after winning the Travelers Championship outside of Hartford.
I feel like I haven't always been able to get it across the line at the tournaments where they're more of a shootout. It's nice to be able to come here where putting is so important and holding the right putts when you need to is so important. And, you know, definitely a little bit of extra satisfaction kind of being able to win on a different style of golf than some of my previous wins have been. I don't really define myself by my wins or by my losses, and so I do my best to compete and have the right attitude. And it's been a tremendous year, and I'm grateful to have some wins, and I'm looking forward to playing in the Open Championship, playing in the Olympics, and then playing in the playoffs as well. I don't set long-term goals. I never have. I've always been best just when I stay in the present, and I have what I would call dreams and aspirations, and those will probably never change. But as far as goals for the year, nothing really changes for me. I'd show up, and it's most important for me to have the right attitude. Anytime you're able to represent your country, wearing the flag is something that very few people get to experience, and I'm very proud to be representing the USA at the Olympics, and I'm very grateful. That's something that I've been looking forward to a long time, and was hoping to be able to be a part of that team, and hopefully we'll be able to bring home some medals for the USA.
So, Bob, a great win for him. I mentioned at the outset, Patrick Harrington won the Dick's Sporting Goods Open for the third straight time up in Endicott, New York, the old BC Open at Enjoy Country Club. That's propelling him into this week. What's really a cool week, Bob? I mean, you talk about history at the U.S. Senior Open, Newport Country Club. It's one of the five founding member clubs of the United States Golf Association, along with a club that I believe you know all too well in Shinnecock Hills, St. Andrews Golf Club in New York, the Country Club, and Chicago Golf Club. Newport Country Club, Bob, hosted the very first U.S. Amateur and the very first U.S. Open in back-to-back days in 1895. In terms of the history of our game in this country, Robert, you get any better?
It certainly didn't, and I don't want to hear any remarks from Kelly Elvin saying, how was it, Bob, when you covered that first Open in 1895?
I thought it was the second Open, but that's okay.
I did, 100 years later, cover the second one, which was at Shinnecock in 1986. And it was an Open that propelled Shinnecock to the top of the world as far as U.S. Open tests, and it still resides there currently.
Couple of nuggets. That first U.S. Open, 1895, was won by Horace Rollins, a 21-year-old Englishman. He won a grand total of $150. The prize fund was $335, Bob. At that time, Newport Country Club was a nine-hole course. So they played it four times. They played 36 holes in a single day with Rollins winning. Modern day, of course, Tiger won the 1995 U.S. Amateur at Newport Country Club. Annika captured the 2006 U.S. Women's Open there. Bob, it's a stunning place. I mean, right by the Atlantic Ocean, a clubhouse that really looks like a mansion. It just seeps golf, right?
It really does, man. Matter of fact, even if you don't play Newport Golf Course, if you just visit and walk the grounds, you'll be totally satisfied with the experience.
Congratulations to our friend Gary Koch, who we had on before the U.S. Open. Gary Koch, at age 71, is now the oldest to qualify for the U.S. Senior Open. 71 years, 7 months, and 6 days when he hits his first drive on Thursday at Newport. Now, Bob, he's got a ways to go. Harold Jug McSpadden, back in the war years, as he was trying to chase down Byron Nelson, and I believe Jug holds the record for most second-place finishes in tour history. Jug McSpadden was 81 in 1990 when he played in the U.S. Senior Open. He holds that record, but who knows, with Gary Koch with that swing 10 years from now, why not?
And it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
No question about it. And speaking of good guys, I know you were really touched in talking with Rhett Evans, and for good reason. You know, we had Rhett on a few months ago, and we said, look, get to the top, come back safely. Please come back on the show. He certainly did. And you're going to absolutely be inspired and thoroughly enjoy this interview with Rhett Evans, which you'll hear right after these words from our Musings on Golf partners. Like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to WilliamandHarry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Celebrating its 30th year, the South Florida PGA Golf Pass offers the ultimate summer golf experience with special access to more than 100 private, semi-private, and public golf facilities. From May 1st through October 31st, Golf Pass members can enjoy special low rates, exclusive member-only outings, special offers, and more. For just $60, you can purchase the South Florida PGA Golf Pass and instantly gain access to all these great benefits through the member-only app. It's simple. Pay, download, play. Visit sfpgagolf.com/golfpass for more information. That's sfpgagolf.com/golfpass. Bob, it was February 20th of this year, 2024, when we last spoke with Red Evans, CEO of the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America, as he was planning an extraordinary adventure to try to reach the summit of Mount Everest. And at 3:13 a.m. on May 23rd, remarkably, he did just that. We at Musings on Golf are thrilled to welcome him back to talk about the many challenges and myriad thrills of reaching the highest point on Earth. Hey, Red Evans, congratulations. We're so pleased you've achieved your incredibly lofty goal. Congratulations, my friend.
Well, thank you. It's certainly good to be back, and you used the word thrilled to have me. I don't think anyone's more thrilled than my wife and myself to be back on solid ground. But looking forward to our conversation today, gentlemen.
Hey, Ray, congratulations on what you accomplished. Can I ask you, what's the first word that you said when you achieved that lofty goal?
Grind. It was a grind.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that word has a lot of, you know, sometimes it can seem negative, but for me, you know, anytime you push yourself and whether you're on a golf course and you're grinding through a golf hole that's difficult, or you're grinding through life, you know, when you get out on the other side, and Bob, to your point and to your question, you know, when you accomplish something like Mount Everest, that was a grind, you really do feel good. You feel like you're a better person, and that you've overcome some things that hopefully make you stronger and give you some life lessons that can benefit you down the road.
You talk a little bit there, Red, about the challenges involved in reaching the summit of Everest and how you endured it. I know you had several injuries.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, that we've got a lot of, hopefully, a lot of Everest fans, if you will. Yeah, it's a very highly publicized mountain, and it's got movies after it, et cetera. But, you know, when I look at all that's out there, a lot of things aren't really shown or talked about regarding the mountain. And one of those factors is just getting there. You know, most mountains, whether it's Denali, Aconcagua, Elbrus in Russia, et cetera, all the, you know, some of the tallest mountains in the world on each of those continents, you can get to them fairly easily. On Everest, we spent, you know, almost 2 weeks, 40 miles, 9,000 feet of elevation, working through the Himalayas, out of a little town called Lukla, where it's really the last airport, or it's the last, you know, place that you can land. And then you trek to the base camp. So just getting to the base camp itself is a challenge. And unfortunately, I was met with some bad food. I ended up getting food poisoning about 3 days in that really set me back to the point where I thought I was going to need to tap, you know, high fever, extreme pain, 3 days of, you know, just really being down and out and losing some weight in the process. And, you know, when you start off a 50-day expedition and 3 days into it, that's what you're met with. It really starts to weigh on you, and you start to question, and, you know, you fight through that, and you kind of put in the practice of, let me just get through one more day. Let's see what tomorrow brings. It'll be brighter. And you know, as I continued to make the trek and fought through that, you know, the next challenge was a acclimatization climb where I had a fall and really damaged my shoulder, my arm, and my leg, to the point where, again, I thought I was going to need to ring the bell and tap. And I think it's just a great lesson that there's way around things, that, you know, we can obviously rely on other people. We can, you know, push through and really have the mental capacity to outdo some of our physical weaknesses. And, you know, and that I was able to do, to where ultimately I positioned myself for a summit bid after multiple acclimatization hikes and climbs and really preparing myself for the summit, but then was met with some dehydration and some just major challenges on the mountain, whether it was with traffic, whether it was with you know, other climbers and where my body was at physically. It was weak. It was you know, lost a bunch of weight. And so we'll get to how we made all that work and how we got to the summit, but I'll leave it there, because those were, you know, three challenges that really rung my bell, that, you know, caused me to think, should I really be out here? You know, the food poisoning, the parasite, the shoulder injury, the fall, and then certainly just the grind of the summit push with dehydration and weight loss.
Going through those challenges, right there. Did the mountains seem to get higher? And let me ask you this. How long did you plan this climb? And how long did it take from start to finish? And were you alone in your climb?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously I've been preparing for this. My parents would say for my whole life. You know, I grew up climbing in Prescott, Arizona, and from a young kid, I always, you know, wanted to be adventurous. And Mount Everest is the pinnacle, right? It's the highest mountain in the world at 29,035 feet. And so I've been looking at this mountain for a long time and preparing for it, you know, by doing other mountains and other training. But, you know, when to your question, Bob, I've seen a lot of big mountains and I've been on a lot of big mountains, but nothing compares to the Himalayas, to when you first see Mount Everest. It's just massive. It's ominous. It's, you know, it sits in the jet stream. And so there's only a certain time during the year where, you know, climbers can actually summit it because of the high winds that ultimately subside for a bit, to where you can touch the summit and get back down. And so it really is. It's a lot like life and some of our own problems, where they, you know, you're looking at them and you feel like it's just a monster. It's just too big. It's ominous. And I really had to step back away from it and not look at, you know, the how grand it was and how large it was, and just start taking it really one step at a time. And not looking up. And I think that's a lot like life, right? We're dealing with a big problem or a bad golf game or whatever. And, you know, we start looking at the 18th hole rather than the hole we're playing. We're going to run into trouble. And I really put that practice into play here, where, you know what, just one day, one step at a time. And it worked for me. You know, to put that in perspective to your last question, Everest takes almost 50 days from start to finish, from arriving into Kathmandu and ultimately summiting and then coming back down and getting home. It's a massive undertaking. The reason it takes so long is there's a lot of things that have to happen with your body as it acclimatizes. You can't rush that. You know, you're developing red blood cells. And so it's not just something that you press a button on and away you go. You literally have to put in your time on the mountain to have your body change to where you can live at a higher altitude. and then ultimately climb at a higher altitude.
Just to follow up on Bob's question, because I want to be sure we get this from you. Were you from the base camp to the actual climb? Were you by yourself? Were you with a guide? How does that work?
Yeah, so you know, the way Everest works, there's multiple what they call expedition companies that secure permits for climbers, and then they're responsible for their safety. They're responsible for a lot of the logistics. And so I was fortunate to be with a great group called Pioneer Expedition. We had 15 individuals that were permit worthy to climb the mountain. And so you certainly work together as a team throughout that process and in different climatization climbs, et cetera. But when it really gets down to the summit push, which is not from base camp, well, I mean, technically it starts at base camp, but when you really go for the summit, you're all the way up at what's called the high camp of Camp 4. And you climb with a Sherpa. A Sherpa is an ethnic group. They are highly trained climbers. They live at high altitude. They're just phenomenal. What they can do is almost like just having a terrific caddy that you're relying on to kind of coach you and walk you through those tough moments and give you the right equipment, et cetera. And my Sherpa, to answer your question, Kelly, as it related to you know, climbing by myself, he had been called on a rescue early in the evening. A climber was suffering quite badly up on the mountain, and he went to try and rescue and to help this downed climber. And so unbeknownst to me, I'm getting ready and getting ready for my golf match here. And I'm looking around and there's no caddy, no Sherpa, you know, and I'm relying on him to, you know, to help me. And he wasn't there. And I talked to the lead Sherpa and he basically said, you've got this. You know, he will be up there for you. You're a strong climber. He'll be about, you know, he shared where he'd be on the triangular face, it's called, right below the balcony. And he said he'll be there. That's where the rescue is. So go by yourself. And he will then finish the climb with you. And so that was a bit, to be quite honest, scary. That was a bit pushing me out of my comfort zone, you know, to be up there climbing by myself. But fortunately, I was able to reconnect with my Sherpa, my caddy, if you will. And we were able to finish the rest of the round, which got us to the top of the summit and back down safely.
Hey, Red, let me say this, and I'm saying it with tears rolling down my cheeks. For anybody out there listening that has something in their future that they think is a challenge that they may not be able to achieve, I want them just to think of Red Evans, and I want them to think of Mount Everest. There is nothing in this life you cannot do if you train properly and execute even better. So for everybody that's going to be able to take advantage of what you achieved, Red Evans, I thank you. There is nothing. Life is too short. There's no challenge too big. You're an inspiration, not only to people that are trying to climb mountains, but to people even just trying to pay their rent. Red Evans, not many people can reduce me to tears, but you certainly have accomplished that.
Well, thank you, Bob. And I really do appreciate that. And I love your message. It was well said. And I want to say that it's true. And it sounds, you know, we've all heard it, right? And we've all had those pats on the back. But it is amazing what we can do as humans and what we can do with a great support system and encouragement. And I, too, want to echo those sentiments. You know, I'm just an ordinary Joe. I'm not a professional climber. I run the Golf Course Superintendent Association of America and serve our 20,000 members and absolutely love what I do. So I don't spend, you know, my entire time on a mountain, but yet, you know, through the preparation, through, you know, my experiences, and then really just putting my mind at work. And I really do believe that our minds are the most powerful tool that any of us can harness to create all levels of success in life. And ultimately, you know, those thoughts that we can create shape who we are and who we will become. The capacity with each of us is really untapped and unknown. But when we take that courage and make that first step and try to, you know, figure out, okay, I've got to change this and I've got to change that, that it does get brighter and things do get worked out. But we've got to have the faith and the fortitude to take that first step. And then the rest follows. And a lot of it is through that momentum. And so anyway, I'm probably off on a tangent here, but I love what you said. And that is my message, that yes, you can, you know, even though you feel sometimes you can't, at the end of the day, yes, you can. We're amazing people.
Well, we are so pleased to be joined by Red Evans, CEO of the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America, who successfully reached the summit of Mount Everest on May 23rd. So Red, I get the next couple of questions. And I know that you effectively used social media to chronicle your journey. I know you had a lot of support there. But before we talk with that, can you just give us a sense for a guy living in the middle of this country? And I know you talked about some of the other mountains that you've climbed, but how did you actually train where you live day to day? How did you train for Everest? And how long of a training period was it before you got in that plane and headed over there?
Yeah, no. And I think that's, again, going back to our earlier conversation about, you know, finding success, you know, it doesn't come without effort. You know, we just can't wish and hope it all comes to fruition. And so Kelly, you know, the training was intense. And even though, you know, I live in the middle of the country with not a lot of big mountains around, we certainly have treadmills. We certainly have Stairmasters. We certainly, as I travel, have the ability to take a 50-pound weight vest in a piece of luggage, and would open that up and spend hours at 4 a.m. in a stairwell at a hotel, going up and down, up and down, up and down. And you've got to be relentless and religious in that approach and committed to it. And so for 6 months, I missed maybe a handful of workouts, and even with my travel schedule, I made it work. And committed to it and found, you know, the time that it takes to really train. And there were long Saturdays of, you know, 6 to sometimes 16 hour days where you want to really push yourself to where when you're on the mountain and you've got to do a 16-hour day, it's not new to you. Your body, your mind, everything is prepared for that moment when you've got to hit that shot, when you've got to make that climb. And so preparation really is key to success in anything that we do in business and golf and in climbing mountains. And I really put the time in to be prepared. I don't know if that answered all your questions there, Kelly, or not.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And as I mentioned, I know you had a lot of support from loved ones, from friends, and you needed it. So the follow-up question is, and you really needed it, because the realities of what you were doing were beyond dangerous. In fact, three climbers lost their lives the same week that you reached the top of Everest. And in doing a little reading, 8 people in all have died this year alone in trying to do it. I'm wondering, did you know about those three who had died? And Rhett, how did you deal with the very real potential of possibly dying trying to achieve this goal?
Yeah. And I'll go back to your first question and make a comment there about, you know, just the individuals and the support system that I had. And Kelly, I really think that was key. You know, you do feel alone, you're isolated. You're in a sleeping bag for 50 days, you know, at 17,500 feet at base camp. It's dark, it's cold, you're eating unknown food for a long time, and it can be lonely. And to know, and in those dark moments, to think about loved ones, to think about friends and family, and think about things that you appreciate and the gratitude that you have for the life we live, those are all things that buoy you up. And they certainly did for me, knowing that I had that support system and people rooting for me. I could feel it. And I think, again, I keep relating this back to golf, but, you know, you see these golfers that, you know, they just or sports athletes that just get pumped up with the home game because they know the crowd's there for them and they feel, you know, that they want to perform their best. And I felt that on the mountain. And it really did. It helped me get up the mountain. And unfortunately, when we go back to the summit push, I mentioned that my Sherpa was called out on a rescue, and we were to summit or leave Camp 4, which is at 26,500 feet for the summit at 8 p.m. At 7 p.m., my Sherpa was gone and already on this rescue. And so as I geared up and putting on the crampons and the harness and getting the oxygen, everything situated for this climb, and I headed out on my own to find my Sherpa and to go up the mountain, I realized that the rescue that he was on was extremely serious. And when I approached it, I realized that this individual is probably not going to make it. And we did everything that we could, provided our own oxygen for this climber who had ran out and who had basically exhausted his efforts, and tried everything we could to get to help him move him down the mountain unsuccessfully. And so he literally passed away while we were there. The next 3 hours, as I was climbing in the dark, I could only think about him. Did he have a family? What did he leave behind? How were those relationships? Did he have regrets? I mean, all of these things came into my mind in the dark as I was, you know, going towards the summit. And it was just such a great life lesson. And even though it's tragic and what happened to this individual is terrible, but yet it reminded me of how fragile life is, and that you know, that we all need to not take for granted the days that we have with loved ones, the days that we have to do things that we normally wouldn't do, and to experience life in a way that's just uplifting. And so, you know, that was something that stuck with me, obviously. And then unfortunately up at the top, as we were approaching the summit, about 250 yards from the summit, I saw another headlamp, and it was shining into the night. And I thought, it's just not a place where somebody stops. It's on a very technical section, and soon realized that we had another climber in a similar situation. And so of those three, Kelly, two I took part in, if you will, and was really affected by that. And, you know, again, it just really made me ponder my own life and how valuable it is, and that you just don't want to ever miss a moment.
You mentioned about the weight loss and so forth. What did you eat? What did you drink? I read or saw that you lost about 25, 26 pounds. Is that right? And what did you eat? What did you live on?
Yeah. Well, and you know, and as I started, you know, I shared, you know, the food poisoning that I had, that actually, for full disclosure, came from a yak steak of all things. There wasn't a lot of protein up there, so I thought I would try yak steak. And didn't agree with me, obviously, but most of the food is centered around, I climbed with the Nepali team, so it was very authentic to what they eat. A lot of rice, a lot of what are called momos, like kind of dumplings, and, you know, just very influenced by Indian culture and Indian food. And while I enjoy that, I love it. After eating it day in and day out for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, my body just finally just kind of shut down, and just even the smell of certain foods would make me sick. And so I started to try to do everything I could with my own nutrition to add calories. But the challenge that you have at altitude is that your body, even at night, is burning almost three times the amount of calories that it's burning at sea level. And so, you know, you're burning just sleeping, you know, and going through the day, just a ton of calories. And so, you know, that was ultimately what led to my weight loss of 26 pounds. And I go back to what we were talking about with Bob, with the mind and the power of it. For me to lose 26 pounds, I'm not a big guy. And that meant loss of muscle. That meant loss of my physical abilities. And so for the mind to take over on that summit push, where I was just able to do it in a just a crazy fast time. I summited in 7 hours and 13 minutes and was down back to camp 4 in 3 hours. I look back on that, and it's physically not possible for who I am. It was just a power of the mind and just the ability to just go. And so, so that weight loss, Kelly, was real and it affected me, but we were able to figure out a way around it. And fortunately for some goos and other little snacks that I had brought with me, some power bars and some pro bars, et cetera, I survived.
Well, Red, you know, certainly saddened to hear that other mountain climbers didn't make it. But I take such great heart in knowing that I can safely say, based on the powerful words of Red Evans, that they passed away doing something that they truly loved. I mean, there's great comfort. If every one of us knew and we had that crystal ball that we're all going to leave Earth doing something that we truly love, wow. And I know one thing, the average golfer playing against Red Evans, the last hole's a par 3 over water, and I went first, and I knocked it on the green, I would fully anticipate looking over to Red Evans, expecting to see fear in his eyes. But what I witness is a smile on his face, and I say to myself, forget it. He's going to make two. He's going to win the match. And he's doing it by doing something that he truly loves.
Brett, your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm just Bob's painted this vision, this beautiful picture. I've got the par 3 in my mind. I've got the water in my mind. I've got his shot in my mind. And I just I'm sitting there thinking what club I'm using to stick it closer and to knock that two in. But I love the way that he articulated that, because we all have those moments, right? Whether it's on a golf course or it's in a boardroom or it's a decision we're making with a relationship or it's an addiction we're trying to overcome. We all have that tough par 3 shot over water. We all have a Mount Everest. It's just a part of our mortal life. Nobody is immune to it, right? Tiger Woods, the greatest golfer, is not immune to health issues. You know, I can go down the list. And so, you know, when we're struck in those moments and we have those moments, you know, that ability to have that confidence and to say, you know what, I can do this. Yes, I can. And to have that mindset and to realize that, you know what, if I don't make the shot, it's not going to be the end of the world. But these adversities, these obstacles, they're simply temporary. But what's permanent is what we become by the way we react to them. And that's just what I took away from this climb, is that, you know, I had adversities, I had setbacks, everything didn't go the way I wanted. I probably did miss this shot, and Bob probably took my money on this par 3. But you know what, it's okay, because I tried, I stepped up there, I did my best. And really, I think if we can all walk away with that mindset, we're going to go through life a lot happier. We're not going to feel as disappointed. And hopefully we're going to be able to help other people along the way that are needing that support in a time of need, when they just hit one in the water or they don't have their Sherpa to take them up Mount Everest.
Hey, Red, let me ask you this. Did you take any Golf Course Superintendents Association items with you to the summit?
Oh, absolutely. First and foremost, they're in my heart. I just love our members. You know, they're just so good for the game and what they bring to a golf course everywhere in terms of their work ethics, et cetera. But physically, I brought and I carried, it was a Velcroed on my sleeve of my down suit. the GCSA logo. And then once I reached the very top of the world, 29,035 feet, it was with great honor that I dug into my backpack and pulled out two flags. The first was a flag that said, "Colleen, I love you. Kate, I love you. Seth, I love you. My two kids and my wife." And then secondly was a flag that said, "GCSAA, onward." And that just meant the world to me to be able to fly those two flags on the top of the world and to really wave and recognize, you know, those entities, those groups, those people that are in my life that makes my life complete. And so what an honor it was to do that.
Speaking of honors, Red, when people ask me, "Well, you've been very lucky in your life, Bob." And I say, "I certainly have." Now I've been able to talk to Alan Shepard, who hit a 6-iron on the moon. And I've talked to Rhett Evans, who put his heart and soul on the summit of Mount Everest. I can't thank you enough from me, and I'm not strong enough to say the proper goodbye, so I'm going to turn that over to my good friend, Kelly Elbin.
Well, thanks, Bob. Rhett, final question for me. You talked about early on that this was a grind. You talked about the being a better person, the life lessons that you learned. And then at the end of the year, you talked about family. And I'm wondering, with your wife, with your two kids, what was that like for you when you got back home, when you made it, when you saw your family and the emotions of being reunited with them?
Yeah, Kelly, the very first thought was the face of those two climbers. I literally saw those two climbers and in my family, and it just made a connection there. And whether they were with me or they weren't, it was just this thought that I had that they were, and that, you know, they were telling me as a climber, as a compadre, as a comrade, that, you know what, this moment, right now, this moment that you get to be able to wrap your arms around your wife and to tell her how much you love her and to kiss your kids, is just so, so cool and so valuable. And don't ever forget it, and don't ever take it for granted. That's the feeling, Kelly, I had when I was able to meet them there at the airport.
Red, it's been an honor. I've known you for quite some time, and I know that our listeners, and certainly you heard from Bob, have gotten to know you in ways that we may never have anticipated. This has been extraordinarily special. Congratulations again from your friends here at Musings on Golf. And I know that the members of the Golf Course Superintendents Association have not only a great leader day to day, but just an outstanding person. And we wish you all the very best going forward.
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. Thank you, Kelly. Keep up the good work, gentlemen.
Like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry. And when you place your order for those fabulous William & Harry golf shoes, remember to put in the promo code 10OFF, M-O-G. That's the number 10, OFF, M-O-G, like in Musings on Golf. Well, Bob, what do you say after hearing that? You hear these things sometimes about inspiration, and then you talk to someone who truly has inspired. A remarkable person, Bob Bupka, and a remarkable accomplishment.
Really is. And as we were recording that, I'm on the edge of one of the great bodies of water in the world. I almost feel like I could go out and get on top of that surface and walk on water like like it was solid ground. And I think a lot of listeners are going to get a lot of inspirations. No, probably none are going to get the inspiration to climb Mount Everest, but in your own personal life, to get that job that you want, to get that wedding proposal handled the way you want, just to raise your children the way you want. Rhett Evans has an endless supply of inspiration. The reality of his accomplishment, 3 climbers during his climb passed away doing what they loved to do, and that was climb mountains. The ultimate sacrifice was made as they climbed the greatest mountain on earth, Mount Everest.
Beautifully said, Robert. We certainly thank Rhett Evans. Next week, we're going to take a little bit of a different road. A gentleman by the name of John O'Hurley, you might have known him as Jay Peterman from Seinfeld. John also hosts the National Dog Show. It's on after the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade every year. John's going to be participating along with a lot of other celebrities in the American Century Championship to be played in the middle of July. And John O'Hurley will be our guest next week. And we had a lot of fun talking with him. And you're really going to enjoy hearing from John next week. For Mr. Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin signing off from a very special Musings on Golf episode.